There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to New Books in Psychology. I'm Eugenio Duarte, your host, as well as a practicing psychoanalyst and clinical psychologist in Miami. Today, my guests are Drs. Patricia Garovici and Christopher Christian, editors and contributing authors of the book Psychoanalysis in the Barrios, Race, Class, and the Unconscious, published in 2019 by Routledge, which they are here to discuss with me today. I'd like to tell you a little bit about my guests. Dr. Patricia Garovici is a psychoanalyst in private practice in Philadelphia and New York, an analytic supervisor, and a recipient of the 2020 Sigourney Award for her clinical and scholarly work with Latinx and gender-variant communities. Her single-authored books include The Puerto Rican Syndrome, winner of the Gradiva Award and the Boyer Prize, as well as Please Select Your Gender, From the Invention of Hysteria to the Democratizing of Transgenderism, and the book Transgender Psychoanalysis, A Lacanian Perspective on Sexual Difference. Dr. Christopher Christian is a psychoanalyst in private practice in New Haven, Connecticut, and co-editor of the book Psychoanalytic Perspectives on Conflict with Morris Eagle and David Wolitsky. He is also co-editor with Michael J. Diamond of the book The Second Century of Psychoanalysis, Evolving Perspectives on Therapeutic Action. He serves as Dean of the Institute for Psychoanalytic Training and Research, also known as IPTAR, where he is also a supervising and training analyst, and he was co-executive producer of the documentary Psychoanalysis in El Barrio. Patricia and Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us with you.
My pleasure. First, I want to wish you congratulations on receiving a 2020 Gradiva Award for the book you're here to discuss today, Psychoanalysis in the Barrios. For those who are unfamiliar, the Gradiva Award is given by the National Association for the Advancement of Psychoanalysis. How does it feel to have your work recognized in this way?
I want to say, Patricia, how does it feel? Because mm-hmm. This is the second Gradiva Award that you've received. I can say for me, it was quite a pleasant surprise and such a validation of so much hard work. But Patricia, I wonder what you think.
You, that's what it's always, because this time the work of writing was not as solitary as usually is. I have had the experience of writing on my own It is a nice way of forcing yourself to take yourself away from social interactions, family life, clinical demands, but it's a lonely task. In the case of this book project, was very nice because I had an excellent companion, and I want to take the opportunity of this interview to publicly thank Chris, because this book has happened because of Chris. He was his idea. He contacted me and offered me this the possibility of collaborating with this project. That it is a lot of hard work. Editing a collection takes a lot of silent, almost invisible work. So it's such a wonderful reward to see it come to fruition in a book that I feel very proud of, because we have had amazing contributions. We have gathered a selection of wonderful authors that each of the articles in the collections has something very new to teach and to discover. Because when Chris approached me, initially I was a little hesitant, thinking, well, I had already covered over this area. I had already written in 2003 the Puerto Rican syndrome. Is there anything new one could contribute to the field? And thanks to Chris and the contributors in our collection, I have to say that I learned many things, and there are many new things I want to continue learning and exploring. So it was really a wonderful and stimulating process, and even an adventure, I may say.
Now, some of our listeners may know you from your appearance in the 2015 documentary film Psychoanalysis in El Barrio. Was the film an inspiration or a catalyst for the book?
There's a little bit of a history. There were a series of conferences that led up to the film. And so the first one was Latin American Contributions to Psychoanalysis. And this was at the New School for Social Research, co-sponsored by the New School in IPTAR. And then there was a second conference called Psychoanalysis in the Barrio, meaning one. And on the heels of that, we considered doing a documentary that kind of followed the success of Black Psychoanalysts Speak, directed by Basha Winograd. That documentary really took the field, maybe by surprise, but it really captured the attention of so many people. At one point, it was one of the most downloaded, not just videos, downloaded articles in PEP CD-ROM. I don't know if we call it CD-ROM anymore, but PEP Web Online. And so it got so much attention. So following that success, we decided to, and this was co-produced, I should say, by Rich Reichbart, who also co-produced Black Psychoanalysts Speak. Now, the story that I'm smiling because the story that we always tell is that when we, after we filmed the video and we were going to have the grand opening and we were going to show it in this theater at the New School, it's a very historic, beautiful theater with many eminent people speaking there, including Hannah Arendt and other people. It really started in a much smaller venue, because the lesson when you've done presentations, you'd rather have a packed small room than a large one that's halfway packed or with half the audience. So we started with a small venue, as relatively small, about 100 people, and we I had been on the program committee at IPTAR, so we had international guests and had booked rooms before. And so you get your typical maybe 100, 160 in our field is a good showing for a conference. Within the first, I'd say, 2 days, we had already 100 people. And then the question became, so do we go into a venue that's three times the size and risk being in a room that's half empty? But by the end of that week, we had up to 300 people, and then we had 400 people with a wait list. I started becoming worried that there was going to be some kind of safety issue in terms of the, but it was such a, that caught us by surprise. And I think it speaks to an interest in the topic. And the thing that that night, Patricia and I talk about this, there was such an electricity in the air, such a receptivity. There was enthusiastic vocalizations. People would clap, people would nod, people would laugh because there's humor. Anyway, it's such a memorable night. And I think that after that, the two small conferences, then the big success of psychoanalysis in the Barrio, the video, it seemed natural to do something. It's quite different, by the way. I think what Patricia was saying is, and this is Patricia's contribution, it wasn't just tapping into clinical psychologists or psychoanalysts. So it tapped into academics from other fields, from queer theory, from anthropology, politics. And so it really became sort of a book of intersections between different disciplines. And I think that's what's so remarkable about
and also
the book.
To continue on this anecdote that was also an inspiration was that evening that was, we felt there was a sort of fiesta, party, that people were talking back to the screen. And there was this enthusiasm that often is not seen in psychoanalytic events, that level of energy, that there was something new in there, we felt. And what we did in the book was not so much to bring psychoanalysis into the Barrio, but rather to bring this Barrio energy, this life that we felt in that room, to bring it back to a sort of renewed psychoanalysis and living psychoanalysis, that there is something new that the Barrio could offer to psychoanalysis as well. It's not only a book that provides a psychoanalytic frame to address different issues that go from clinical to cultural to anthropological, but also that the Barrio has something to teach us.
You know, I want to say I was there that night, and
and
it was an exciting evening for me personally. You know, I'm from Miami. I come from a Cuban family, but I moved to New York and I lived there for a decade and I trained in psychoanalysis, and the two worlds always felt like two different worlds that didn't really meet. There was a world I occupied in New York on the Upper West Side in my psychoanalytic training, and then there was a world that I occupied here in Miami at the Cuban Bakery down the street. And so it was a chance to be in both worlds at the same time. And I do, now that you mentioned, I do remember people cheering and clapping at certain parts of the film. So clearly there's an energy around, a vitality around this topic. I want to ask about the title, because you use the word barrio, but what exactly is a barrio, and how are you using that term in this volume?
Okay, that's a good question. Thank you. It's interesting. Well, when often when we the connotation of the word in Spanish, barrio, means simply neighborhood, may mean home, so there would be a sort of positive connotation. In the context of the U.S., often barrio represents a marginalized, economically challenged social location, and often a marginalized social location with high levels of poverty and also very high levels of violence. So you may wonder why inserting psychoanalysis in such a controversial context. And if we look at the etymology of the word barrio, it comes from the Arabic barri, that also means exclusion. And what we precisely try to challenge in the book is this idea of the exclusion, that barri would mean outside, that there is there an outside of psychoanalysis? Is there an inside of psychoanalysis? Our argument in the book is that there isn't such a difference, that psychoanalysis And this is often a sad experience I have every time I share at a dinner party, at a lecture hall, my experience working with poor people of color in a various setting. And I share that I have conducted psychoanalytic cures in such a setting. Often the knee-jerk reaction is surprise. It's as if it would be impossible to use psychoanalysis with those people. And what we want to challenge precisely is this imposed border that ultimately, rather than relating to issues of poverty, as if poor people would need an intervention that would be aimed only at immediate result, that they have real problems, quote unquote real, which of course they do have problems that need to be addressed with social means. But that, and I always make the same joke, but I will indulge and say it again, is as the implicit prejudice is as if they were saying that poor people cannot afford to have an unconscious, which is an absurd construction. So people of limited economic means can still have a reverie, can have imagination, can have an unconscious, have sexuality, and can benefit from psychoanalysis. And in the same way, psychoanalysis can benefit from exploring its political emancipatory potential. So it's a two-way road in that sense.
So,
various another yeah, there was the issue of the plural that also Chris mentioned in passing. We pluralize barriers to precisely challenge this idea of exclusion. There is not only one barrier, but there is several barriers, and also to welcome contributions of psychoanalysts from other locations. We have contributions from a historian, Mariano Plotkin, who examines how psychoanalysis was received in Latin America. So we expand the barriers into other similar social locations where psychoanalysis also found a home.
You know, I'd like to read, Patricia, from your chapter. Oh, sorry, Chris, did you want to jump in?
No, go ahead. I'll only say this, that first of all, I'm struck that even this to this day, we're surprised by barrio and psychoanalysis in the same title. There's something almost subversive about it. And I had the same experience back in 1994, I think, when I read Rafael Javier's paper, The Suitability of Insight-Oriented Psychotherapy for the Hispanic Poor. And I thought Hispanic poor and insights-oriented psychotherapy seemed like such separate things. It seemed so subversive to have them. But 20 years later, we still have that reaction. So I wanted to comment on that. But the other thing I wanted to mention, because what Patricia says, we often think of the barrio as a place of misery. But what we saw that night was that the barrio was a place of liveliness, of humor. In one of the conferences, one of the participants told her mom, "Mommy, I'm going to see psychoanalysis in el barrio." And she said, "Ah, saluda." She thinks of the barrio as the place she's going. But that kind of humor we saw throughout that night, and I think it's a different way of having the barrio be present and kind of
so bringing psychoanalysis back home.
That's right. That's right. There's something. Anyway, so that was that.
But,
it's a little
but
bit
but
of an aside.
Home, because as opposed to in what has been the experience of North American psychoanalysis, and by North American, I talk about very north. I would say north of Rio Grande, because Mexico has a different development in psychoanalysis. In the U.S., in particular, psychoanalysis has been associated with a practice. Serving the well-to-do. So psychoanalysis was assumed to be effective only to those who could afford it. Whereas in Latin America, and this is something that for those in the United States comes as a surprise, has been associated with social conscience and we may say more central left movements and has been always been seen as eminently political, whereas in the US, psychoanalysis has developed as a medical subspecialty and given a sort of, I may say, false idea of neutrality. And psychoanalysis has seen itself in the US as divorced from politics and impermeable to the pressures of history. Whereas in Latin America, the experience has been very different. And this is something that Nancy Hollander also illustrates in her chapter in our collection, that for psychoanalysis, she examines the case of Argentina in particular. Political activism and psychoanalytic practice were synonyms. That to be a psychoanalyst in that kind of context meant assuming a political, committed political position and political action, which is very different from how psychoanalysis has developed in the US. And in that sense, the idea of psychoanalysis in the barrio, in the different geographical context, may not be as surprising in the United States, I may say.
But I want to follow up then with a two-pronged question based on this point, which you elaborate in the book. So in certain countries in Latin America, psychoanalysis, as you say, is a political praxis. But I'm wondering, number one, what does the everyday life or practice of a psychoanalyst in such a country look like? And number two, to the extent that that's not the way we do psychoanalysis in the United States, can we change that? And how?
I would say that the paradox is that thinking that psychoanalysis is a non-political practice implies taking a political position. To believe that psychoanalysis is neutral is an ideological position. So I think that it's something that has to do maybe with the history of psychoanalysis that has been assessed by different historians, that how the particular development of psychoanalysis in the US as trying to be more scientific has forgotten that that positioning implies some political, it's a taking of a position, even though it may look seemingly neutral. In terms of how is the everyday life of a psychoanalyst, it's a very interesting question, Eugenio, because I think that there we have to maybe separate how psychoanalysts intervene as citizens. And I think we have seen all of us, if our listeners are our practitioners, we all have seen an important change, I would say, since 2016, at the time Trump got elected, that the conversations on listserv have changed in their tone, that during COVID, that it was very clear that psychoanalysts, we had a social role to play and we could not be divorced from our social context. And I think maybe being forced to practice during the pandemic via Zoom has maybe forced us to question how to think of analytic neutrality in ways that are more productive, both clinically and also political. And I have seen, and it's a development that I personally applaud and welcome happily, that I saw much more political engagement in all different groups, that psychoanalysts had maybe a step out of an illusion of being outside the social link. And so I think that perhaps what has happened during maybe there is more discontent in the United States, I may say. I have a limited experience because I moved to the US in only 1989, but I would say the last 30 years, I see more discontent, explicit, but more political engagement as a result. That reminds me of how was my experience in Argentina, where I am originally from, where people are always unhappy. So they feel that talking about politics is a survival strategy. You need to complain. you need to challenge the status quo, you need to criticize the government, and then you feel more alive. And that's, there is no clear division between your position as an analyst and your assuming a political position as well.
So I also want to go to the question about how we bring psychoanalysis to the barrios. You make the point that in the United States, psychoanalysis is often practiced among the well-to-do, for the well-to-do. But at the risk of being a bit concrete, and given the way that mental health treatment is distributed these days, where folks who are more economically disadvantaged tend to have access to clinics where they see a high volume of patients and not so much to psychoanalytic offices. Is there a way that we can change that?
My proposal will be simple, is by following this idea of bringing the barrio back into psychoanalysis, is that in my private practice, I offer a sliding scale fee. The sliding scale, it slides up and it slides down. So for somebody who is very well to do and can pay a full fee, that's great. But if somebody is willing to do the work and we agree that we could both benefit from the process, that we can work together, I offer a sliding scale fee. And that's how, for instance, I happen to speak Portuguese as well. So there's a big Portuguese-speaking community in Philadelphia. I have many patients in my practice that are maybe cleaning housekeepers, cleaning persons, construction workers, and they are happy to have access to psychoanalysis. I remember talking to a cleaning lady and asking her, well, why did you want to talk to psychoanalysis? She said, well, when I live back in Brazil, I heard that was a good idea to talk one day to psychoanalysts. Now I live in the US, and now that I have this cleaning job that pays me an okay salary, now I can finally do it. So I think one could bring back the barrio into a private office, and I think this is a spirit that has been forgotten and that goes back to the early days of psychoanalysis when during the two world wars Freud had a network of free clinics where he asked any psychoanalyst that was part of the very early emerging psychoanalytic movement to provide at least 1 hour of pro bono work a week. So for Freud, in the early days of psychoanalysis, the psychoanalyst was meant to provide a sort of social service, we may say, or have a more varied politically and socially engaged practice. Yes, Chris, I think you were.
Well, in your question, Eugenio, there's an important implication that's made very automatically. And I think Patricia has said this in her writing, and that in the United States, the assumption is that Hispanic equals poor. And so we immediately know what you're talking about when we say, how do we work with the Hispanic, given that they don't have so the assumption, and I think it's probably a correct one in a way, that to speak of Hispanics in the United States is to speak of a poor minority. And so then the question is it that there's a rejection of, Puerto Rican patients in private practices because they're not amenable to psychoanalysis, or is it a financial choice that the analyst is making? We, in 1998, Richard C. Friedman, Wilma Bucci, and I conducted a research of the practices of senior psychoanalysts who were members of the American Academy of Psychoanalysis. And we found out that the median income back then of the patients in this sample was $200,000. In other words, they were treating relatively well-to-do patients. And it wasn't that they were treating the worried well, because another thing that research showed was that, in fact, they were very severely ill patients that were being treated in private practice. But for the most part, they were treating well-to-do patients. And there's a scene, by the way, in the video, is very poignant. And you may remember when Ernesto Mojica talks about a patient, where the patient is worried about asking him whether he could use the couch. And Ernesto says, well, why do you hesitate to ask? And he says, because I think it's for the well-to-do. In other words, that even the bias, even the patient understands the bias that exists in keeping them off the couch. So it's a financial question, not just a clinical one. And I think that's very important.
What we may say that Ernesto is a beautiful, very moving passage in the documentary. What he illustrates is the idea that there is only one resistance in analysis, the analyst's resistance, not the analysant's resistance. That if the analyst is willing to overcome maybe the shared prejudice and in a way honor psychoanalysis as a practice of hospitality. When I mentioned this, somebody made the joke that we are in the hospitality industry. but psychoanalysis is about hospitality. We welcome when somebody contacts you the first time, rings you up. You don't know who you're going. You may talk a little on the phone and have a sense of who is coming to your private practice, but then you open the door of your office and you don't know who you're going to encounter. So it is a practice that, in a way, it entails this leap of faith that we welcome somebody into the private space of our office. And I think that it's important to honor that as the essence of our practice, that we need to extend that practice of hospitality to whoever may benefit from a psychoanalytic intervention.
Now, in the spirit...
Independently of their income.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Mm-hmm. No, sorry.
Yes, in the spirit.
No, I was just going to say that in that spirit, and in the spirit of what we discussed before regarding bringing the barrio and into psychoanalysis, I want to mention Christopher's chapter in the book titled The Analyst as Interpreter, Ataque de Nervios, Puerto Rican Syndrome, and Inexact Interpretation. For us Latinx folks, ataque de nervios is a familiar thing, but for our listeners, Chris, could you please explain what this is and why you think that we should know about it?
Yes. So the ataque de nervios, it's now considered a culture-bound syndrome in the DSM, but and you're right, any person from, especially from Puerto Rico, Cuba, the Dominican Republic, in other countries too, but what is so familiar with it that it's almost, there's a kind of, that familiarity brings a smile when we talk about ataque de nervios because your aunt had one and your girlfriend, whatever. So, but it's in essence, it looks like a seizure. If you see it in a clinic, it's often something observed in Latinas, where following some kind of event, and it's usually precipitated by event. It's not like a panic attack that can happen on cue. It happens, and there's a distress response, and it's a distress response that enlists the intervention of the person's social support network. It always happens when the person is with someone. I mean, I don't know if I include this in that chapter, but one time I asked a group of students when we were talking about ataque de nervios, I said, so would you ever have an ataque? You know, I would ask them, what is it? How do you treat it? Everyone knew. And then I said, would you ever have an ataque de nervios when you're home alone? And a student said, why would you waste an ataque de nervios? The question was surprising to her as to, so it is a social sort of call response that enlists social support. It's in terms of the symptoms, you often hear a person shaking, falling to the ground. It can look like a hyperkinetic seizure. And but maybe what in the chapter, I think what I was trying to show was kind of a couple of things, but one of them is here in the barrio, we see the conversion disorders that Freud was talking about at the turn of the century. On the one hand, you know, we're talking about how you know, hysteria and conversion disorders, which marked the birth of psychoanalysis, were now deemed unamenable to psychoanalysis when presented by a Latina, you know, in a Freudian practice in the Upper West Side, let's say. And there's an irony in that. And so, and when you look at Freud's description of conversion disorders, I mentioned in the chapter how he starts off by, in the neuropsychoses of defense, explaining how certain memories that are repressed, there's an amount of energy tied to them that once then the memory is repressed, the energy tied to that memory needs to go somewhere. And he says, well, it goes into what we call something somatic. It's transferred into something somatic. So he was explaining how certain traumas can then get manifested in the body. And then later on, he elaborates, well, it's not necessarily about discharging affects and maintaining some equilibrium in the organism. It's that these ataques and these conversion disorders have symbolic meaning. And so he goes from what we might think of as an organic or hydraulic type of description to a more psychological one. And I think that's how we understand it nowadays, that it's a certain compromise formation by which, and it's usually a Latina, expresses distress and disavows aggression and sexuality. And so she is able to express things through the ataques that are rendered normal and not jarring, offensive, or going against the social norms of her community. And so the just one last point, when I talk about Glover's idea of the inexact interpretation, Glover had this idea that there's certain interpretations that by virtue of being somewhat removed from the true source of anxiety, provide relief of the anxiety. In other words, they almost serve defensively. And what we see with things like panic attacks, but even ataque de nervios, when you label them, the diagnosis itself can become an inexact interpretation to the extent that it doesn't really address the true sources of the person's impulses, fears, defenses, and compromise formations. But it's not a language. It removes them enough so that it gives some symptom relief. But it complicates then the treatment and the person knowing themselves better and all of that we see in psychoanalysis. And so that was that part of the inexact interpretation that I was.
And what then is Puerto Rican syndrome, and is it different from ataque de nervios?
Well, here the authority on that is certainly Patricia, because there were two books, I think, in my graduate school. Javier had a huge impact on me. And then I come across Patricia's book, The Puerto Rican Syndrome. It's hard to read any other piece of work that addresses it so comprehensively as Patricia. And so I'll defer to her to describe the Puerto Rican syndrome.
Thank you, Chris, for such kind introduction. The Puerto Rican, the same question you asked, Eugenio, I asked myself. I was working in the barrio in my clinic, and there I encountered this strange label, Puerto Rican syndrome. I have never heard in all my studies any other diagnosis associated with a nationality. You don't have French melancholy or American anxiety or Argentinian narcissism, even though these true labels could describe a lot about those cultures. But there is no, in the very wide psychiatric nomenclature, there is no nationality attached to a psychiatric diagnosis. But then you have a Puerto Rican syndrome, and we know that Puerto Rico is not an independent nation. It has a complicated status, Puerto Rico. There it is, a diagnosis that already is quite problematic, not only from a political perspective, but also from a clinical perspective, because looking at it closely, it describes, as Chris said it very well, something that could look initially like a very severe case of epilepsy or a sort of a seizure or an explosion of anger, often destroying objects, but followed by amnesia, attacks of rage, but that look at it closely does not have any, like it would be with a true situation of epilepsy. There is no anatomical correlate. It's there is no organic cause, but a psychogenic cause. It's caused by extreme emotions. In the local idiom, the ataque de nervios is an expected reaction that, interestingly enough, is not considered pathological. In when I remember exploring the literature, it says that if you have an ataque de nervios in New York, you end up in the emergency room and you end up with a terrible diagnosis of severe psychosis. If it happens in San Juan, Puerto Rico, somebody brings a little air, gives you a little alcoholado or the agua de Florida, a little perfume, wipes the sweat from your forehead, and it's done. So we see how the eye of the examiner, that in a way the Puerto Rican syndrome, he also when it appears in the standardized manual of diagnosis, such as the DSM of the American Psychiatric Association, you could see that cultural prejudice transforms otherness into a pathology, because in the local context is considered an expected reaction to severe stress or a loss of a loved one, severe trauma, and in a cultural context in which this cultural form of expression is not sanctioned as normal, is seen as a severe pathology. The other interesting thing that I encounter examining the Puerto Rican syndrome is that historically the label was invented in the 50s. During the Korean War, which is something I take again in my contribution to the collection, that also expresses the very complex position of a Puerto Rican citizen who is at the same time an American citizen who is fighting during the Korean War with the U.S. flag and also carrying the Puerto Rican flag, and explains the complicated position in a sort of post-colonial situation for the Puerto Rican population that is not completely away from a situation of colonial subjection. What I want to say, maybe to put it, maybe make it short, it's a very complex issue, but that at times a clinical manifestation, somebody showing up at a clinic with a reporting that they had an attack the night before, or something that will be labeled as a Puerto Rican syndrome, that what you see that at times a clinical symptom could function as an allegory of a social situation, that the clinical and the social cannot be told apart. That in a way, one individual manifestation could also talk for a suffering shared by a community. And that's something that for which psychoanalysis is uniquely prepared to respond to account for those two levels taking place at once, that one could not look at these symptoms without taking into account the social context, the history of the community, the language that community uses. That, for instance, in my practice in the barrio, was very interesting because I had to learn a new language. Neither my mother talk Spanish was enough, not the English I had learned at school. I needed to be taught by my patients Spanglish, which is this in-between language. And I think that's a nice metaphor of how the suffering is in this in-between situation, being between two cultures, being between two languages, and also in for a population challenged by barriers of class, language, gender, race as well. So, like what we may think, if we imagine that psychoanalysis is a sort of in its most classical presentation, I believe that psychoanalysis is uniquely equipped to address all these levels at once.
Now, if the condition, ataque de nervios, reflects a sociopolitical reality, then does that mean that giving it a DSM diagnosis is a political act or has political, sociopolitical implications?
Yeah, it's a form. I think, unhappily, the DSM suffers from, I may say, and it's a little blunt, but that's what I believe is, it's slightly racist. Certain diagnosis, if you look, for instance, that there is this cluster separated called culturally bound syndromes, it happens to belong to cultures that are other to mainstream American culture, white Anglo-Saxon. So it is surprising that we assume that the only culture that produces manifestations deemed pathological are cultures which are not our own from the perspective. I think that in a way itself, the DSM is a cultural product, is a product of the American Psychiatric Association, and for instance, assumes that a depression is not as pathological as other forms of manifestations that are clustered in this marginal section in the diagnosis, which I think has been the case. It has been in recent years, and maybe Chris has more to add on that, that in our practice, we are not using reliance so much on the DSM. We are using more the IC9. We are becoming aware that this tool, which is a useful diagnostic tool, however, happens to suffer from a lot of bias that could, in a way, prevent us from having a more objective clinical view.
Chris, would you like to weigh in?
Yeah, just to reiterate what a part of what Patricia. Yeah, can you hear me okay? Just to reiterate what Patricia is saying, we know that in certain in hospitals and Hispanic patients and patients of color in general are more likely to receive a more severe diagnosis, are more likely to be treated with medication instead of talk therapy, and are more likely to receive a symptom-focused therapy if the hospital or the internship program happens to have a psychodynamic track as well. They'll be treated with a more symptom-focused therapies. And so there's a segregation that happens even as part of our training.
You know, we're almost out of time. But I wanted to, first of all, thank you for a lively and timely discussion. I want to remind our readers that I'm talking to Drs. Patricia Garavici and Christopher Christian about their book, Psychoanalysis in the Barrios, Race, Class, and the Unconscious. Before we go, I wanted to give you a chance to let us all know what you're up to these days.
Well, I am happy to say, so my practice has moved to New Haven, and so that's new, and I'm working with interns from the Yale internship program. And I'm doing research, and this has been long ongoing, but research on linguistic measures based on one of which is multiple code theory that we apply to psychotherapy sessions to understand not so much the outcome of different therapies, because we know therapy tends to work, but really addressing the more complicated question of how does therapy work? And so that's been my focus for the
fantastic
for the past year.
What about you, Patricia?
Well, having had this wonderful experience of teamwork with Chris, I engage in yet another collection that I recently completed with Manya Steinkohler, also working on this field of psychoanalysis and barriers, not so much focusing on barriers of language and class and race, but the barriers of gender. And so in this intersectional approach, I just completed with Manya Steinkohler a collection on psychoanalysis, gender and sexualities from feminism to trans. That's the the working title so far. We know books evolve, so that may not be the final title, but this is so far our working title. And again, working with the ideal soccer team. With this is for those who like soccer. When you edit a collection, you get to select your dream team of players and enjoy the fantastic game. So I think that thanks to Chris, I discovered that for me the wonderful thing of this type of work is that it takes away the pain of writing. So writing becomes more the side of the pleasure and the adventure and the possibility of discovering things anew, thanks to the illumination of contributors. So that's what we are going to be finalizing this summer.
Well, congratulations to both of you. First of all, on the book, which has been so well received, and also on your individual endeavors. I hope to hear about them once they're out. So thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Eugenio, for inviting us. Great pleasure.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Eugenio.
Thank you.
Thank you.